It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 652. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for show topics at miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message on Skype. My Skype name is Mike Tech Show, all one word. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/miketechshow, and also facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. This show is brought to you by Instant House Call. Remotely support your customers unattended and on demand through firewalls. Try it free by clicking on the link on my website at miketechshow.com. Use the promo code Mike Tech Show for your free 15-day trial. And you can just go directly to instanthousecall.com. Also, I want to welcome Malwarebytes as a sponsor for the Mike Tech Show. Malwarebytes has a portable all-in-one computer toolkit called the Malwarebytes Toolset. This toolset helps you diagnose, remediate, repair, and secure PCs. One of the many great features included is the ability to perform a network device scan of all devices on the local network, and you can export the results to a text file. It's a perfect companion for doing network site surveys. Every member of my team and myself, when we go out to do battle and visit a client, the Malwarebytes tool set is required, and one of the first things we do is that network scan for all devices, get you some great info. Tonight, I have a bunch of things I want to talk about. First, traveling, some tech things, traveling that might help you out. Also, the different RSS feeds and where they generate from and where they come from, because I have an email question on that. And then I have a stack of email asking very specific questions that I'm going to take time and answer. So last week I was traveling. One of the things, I have an iPhone, as you know, not totally happy with it because of the battery issues and the reception and talking sometimes. Now, they just pushed an iOS 11.3 update, and I've got my fingers crossed hoping that this is going to help. I noticed by checking on the performance of my battery, there's like a beta utility now that you can actually look at the health of your battery, and mine's at 99%, and it's looking good. So I haven't went in and got my battery replaced. This is an iPhone 7. While I was away, I rented a Ford Edge. And when I plugged my phone in to just charge, I was presented for the first time with Apple CarPlay. And that was just amazing. One of the things, if you have an iPhone or an Android and you're in the market for a new or used car, I'm going to have a couple links where you should at least check if, based on your phone, what is available in cars. Like, my favorite cars are Toyota, and they have a problem with Apple, and there's no Apple CarPlay. But that Apple CarPlay, you're literally presented on the screen with your iPhone, and to be able to have the instructions right from my contacts to be able to quickly just click and have the map come up, and it was gorgeous. I loved it. One of the frustrating things, and I don't know if this helps somebody, it's a common problem, is the turn-by-turn navigation voice was very low. And the only way, I was looking for every setting under the sun. I spent time trying to find it. My wife, Googling on her phone, found someone that said it was driving them crazy how to get the volume. You have to wait until the voice is speaking. So you have to wait till your saying, you know, turn in 300 feet, or when the voice is speaking, you turn up the volume and that will increase it. It is the only way to increase the volume of the voice for the turn-by-turn navigation. Because if you turn it any other time, it's going to just raise the music. The volume control of exactly what is speaking, and you can raise it. I would have never thought of that. And it's not easy to time when you're trying to do it. But that was a really good find. If you're interested in this, it is definitely a feature. And my next car, depending on what device I have, that is going to be a required feature for me, because I live and die by my GPS in the car. And I need that going to new clients, or I got to pump in where I'm going, and I need good navigation. Sometimes it's the iPhone when I'm traveling, where we would just hold, I didn't even plug it in at first, and I didn't even realize, and we were using my iPhone to navigate where it wasn't plugged in USB. So not until I needed to charge it did I discover that. But just something I wanted to mention. A couple other things when you're traveling. I'll never forget last year traveling to a place where I forgot. I can't believe I didn't have any Ethernet cables, and the hotel had an Ethernet connection. And you always want to use Ethernet in your hotel room as opposed to Wi-Fi if you're given the option. Now, I'm a Marriott Rewards member, and it's why I travel. I run every purchase, no matter what it is, all bills, everything that I possibly can, I run through my Marriott Chase credit card for the points, and I leverage the points for free rooms. And that is exactly what I used last week. I paid nothing for my hotel stay. And when you use points, this is a tip, and you got to check with your individual card. If you're using points for a room, Marriott allows you every four nights, you get one free. But if you're paying out of your pocket, they don't do that. It's only with the points. So when my son and I went to Germany last June, we stayed free at the Courtyard Marriott. At the Marriott last week, where I when I was away, it was free. I'm traveling but by car nearby, but far enough away where I'm staying at a hotel this weekend, I'm using my Marriott points. It's all about the points. I know I promised a show, and I got to reach out to the individuals that were going to help me talk about points, and I was going to dedicate a show to that. That's still on my list. I haven't forgotten, but I wanted to mention this, and also some other added value when you have like gold rewards like I have with the Marriott. No matter where I stay, if you notice, when you're getting the internet, there's the free, and then if you pay like $4.95 a night or whatever, $9.95, you get the extra faster internet connection. I get that free at all times for all my devices. So my wife's devices, my devices, it's very, very convenient. And this way I can have great internet access when I'm traveling, especially at a Marriott. Things you should think of. Always pack an Ethernet cable. Try to maximize your points if you're doing some traveling, so this way you can take advantage of it like I am now. I'm reaping the benefits of all of the points that I have amassed, and they don't expire, or at least I'm using them enough where they don't. Plus, I earn free nights for things. That's how I'm traveling. Another travel tip. This is from Andrew. Mike, not sure if this has been a show topic. I think I discussed this way back. He continues, need your advice. Have a wife and daughter traveling to Italy. Is there a good cell phone option for this? Buy a burner phone or use the below option from AT&T. I love this option. And when I went to Germany, this sounds expensive, but when you look at the options, it's $10 per day for international travel, and then it's your regular plan. So I had unlimited texting and calling from Germany for $10 a day. Now, you have to let them know before you're going, and you can even do this online in your account. It depends on how many days you're traveling, whether you would need a phone or not. For me, getting another phone, nobody has that phone number. It wouldn't help me. You have to get a different SIM card. So having a burner phone really did nothing for me. And when I was done, it would cost me more than the $100 I spent for the 10 nights I was away. So AT&T also offers, but you got to set this to your plan before you travel to Canada or Mexico. Same thing. But I'm changing from AT&T, and I've been with AT&T for a long, long time. T-Mobile is the way to go. You're not going to be charged for the international. I think it's just one small fee for the whole month, and it's not per day, and it's like nominal for T-Mobile. And you absolutely want to take a look. It may be worth changing plans because T-Mobile has the unlimited now. I mean, they really cap you, I think, at 50 gigs per person for your data. 50 gigs, that's insane. I don't even use a gig per month. You want to take a strong look at moving from T-Mobile. Right now, all my kids have moved to their own T-Mobile plan. My wife and I are going next since we're both over 55. I think they still have the $30 per person per month for unlimited. T-Mobile has some great free Tuesday. You know what last week they had? The free MLB premium for the year, which is valued at like $120. And you got that free just by being a member of T-Mobile. There are lots of freebies that T-Mobile is really throwing at everybody. I'm thinking of doing that. Andrew, if you're staying with your AT&T, that international day rate is the best option. When I was exploring all my options, what can I do to maximize my coverage while I was traveling to Europe? And you already found it. So that is going to be, I think, your answer. Let's continue with the rest of the email. This is from Mike. As always, thanks for the great information. You talk about the different utilities you use for the different security applications. And I remember show 595, you went through a solid layer of protection. The question I have is, do you have different protocols depending on business size, i.e., 1 to 20 workstations, up to 50 workstations, 100 plus workstations, etc. Again, appreciate the time and effort you put into the show and knowledge you put out there for us listeners. Mike, thank you for the question. My sweet spot is typically right now small businesses 5 to 20. I do have one that has 56 workstations. With that, I really approach security based on, am I following a certain type of compliance? Is there a parent company or organization that has requirements that I have to fit? An example, I have a client from, let's say, Keller Williams Real Estate, and there's a corporate standard that has to be followed possibly, then I would follow it. Or I would say Ameriprise Financial Advisor. I have to obey some of the standards put forth by Ameriprise. Now, if it's an independent company, I select the firewall based on the requirements, the reporting that they need, and the compliance level. If they don't need intrusion protection, intrusion prevention, detection, if they just need a basic business firewall, then that's what I'll select. When it comes to the desktop, I'm pretty standard on Windows Defender or Security Essentials, which really Windows Defender now for Windows 10, and Malwarebytes Premium. That's my go-to standard for my workstations. And then applying patches as necessary, monitoring the systems for when updates are needed for all the software, maybe using Nynite and software like that to keep things updated. But based on the size, I really don't change between 5 and 30. There's no real change. If I got to worry about PCI compliance, then I may be doing something different where I'm isolating those point of sale systems. If I got HIPAA compliance, I may be adding a layer of more policies at the local level. Is there a domain controller where I can apply group policies? Is there a real server involved? And usually the larger number of users, there's going to be a server. Am I inheriting something where I'm continuing to maintain it? Or am I recommending changes? Or am I rolling something out brand new? That's going to play into it because sometimes they've already made an investment. I had a company that made the investment for 3 years for Norton Cloud for every workstation. Well, that's an investment they already made. I'm not going to rip that out since they spent the money. I'll wait until it's done and then make my recommendation. So there's lots of factors, and there's nothing I can just generalize except you need a base standard to work from where you have the antivirus that you want. You have the protection for malware, ransomware. Are you deploying Crypto Prevent on all the systems? Have a good, solid standard that you would recommend and use, and then you could just scale it up for the more workstations. If it was like a malware bite, you would want the business rollout where you can control it from a server if you got that many workstations. You wouldn't just use the individual because that would be too difficult to maintain. The number of workstations that come into play, I would make changes based on automation. If I hit a certain level of workstations, then I'm going to really want Nynite Pro to help me update for that many workstations for all the different software applications that need to be updated that Nynite Pro supports. Things like that you need to consider. I hope I helped you. You now have more questions from that. And if you do, just follow up and I'll be glad to tackle them. This is from Dexter. You had an email with a USB keyboard and mouse problems. This may be due to a Microsoft patch for Windows 10. And he has the link from Computer World, and uninstalling and letting it reinstall seems to fix. I have heard of more and more keyboard and mouse problems. I had this once when I rolled out Driver Max on a client that I just needed some extra drivers and I couldn't find them. Driver Max found them, but then caused a problem with the keyboard and the mouse. And that gets difficult once you lose them. How do you get back in? You try safe mode and try getting in or going back to a restore point from whatever that update was. And once I smell a driver's update problem, I want to go back prior to that update and I want to then disable driver updates and then continue on. Now, he has a question. Drawing on your Exchange experience, when is Exchange database too big? What maintenance should be done on a regular basis? I'm having trouble finding best practices. I have no clients with a local Exchange server anymore. Every one of my clients has been migrated to hosted Exchange server in the cloud. So now the maintenance is all on the Exchange provider, on the host provider for those services. It's been a while since I've been running the maintenance scripts on a local Exchange server. There are best practices, and I'm going to reach out to Winston Wolf for some assistance here and see what he recommends. I'm almost positive there are best practices that Microsoft has based on the Exchange server version that you have. I know there are. So, Dexter, I'm going to email you some, and I'm going to actually find some of these links, and I will put them in the show notes. There are PowerShell scripts that need to be run, and a lot of it, I remember the last Exchange server management that I've done, and most of it when I left the corporate world was all included in Small Business Server. The maintenance scripts were all included, and it was all very easy to do from Small Business Server. Now, how big? It can get pretty big, but again, the database size is based on the Exchange server version that you're using. And again, I'm going to find the links that has those exact size limits, but it's pretty big. You can get pretty large. Lastly, you say you have retainer clients. Please explain this. How you come up with the fee and what is included and not. I have prepaid hours and contract hours. Both everything is scheduled and rate is reduced. One, prepaid hours, customer buys a block of hours up front at a reduced rate and then works against it. That's really what I'm doing, only I'll tell you how I present it a little differently. And then there's two contract hours, customers in a contract for a set number of hours for a period of time. Example, 2 years reduced rate. They pay first and last month up front, then make monthly payments till duration of contract has expired. If they exceed total contract hours before the contract is over, they are billed excess at lower rate till the contract's up. Also, they can purchase special project blocks of hours at lower rates. This is to save contract hours. Thanks. Okay, Dexter, my retainer is basically quarterly blocks of hours. We take a stab at how many hours they're going to need for support, including what I'm monitoring, where it might be an hour or two a month. I'm monitoring backups. I'm doing whatever that I'm stating in the scope of work. I then bill for the quarter that's going to happen. So I send out an invoice to my retainer client for the next 3 months. Then I actually keep track of the hours. So it's sort of like pre-buying the hours, but I will then invoice them at the end of the quarter, the increase, if they needed additional hours, and it's at that reduced rate, or I roll over. I'm starting to want to not do that. If they don't use all the time, they like to hear that it kind of rolls over. It's like 18 minutes. That's something I'm still toying with, not doing, but all my clients right now, the legacy clients, that's in effect. Then I have clients, they use me so much, we don't even have a retainer contract. I just bill them at the reduced rate. I bill them at a retainer rate. So I have a rate, whether it's a block of hours or that retainer contract, that it's all poor work. There's nothing guaranteed unless I'm monitoring the backups and I'm doing a couple things. And then part of those hours are towards that. An example, client has a server, but they only need like 5 hours a month for support. Now, in that, I do quarterly maintenance and things that chews up some hours. But also, there's an hour a month for me monitoring the backup of the server. Right off the bat, now they're down to four. When I'm doing maintenance, that's 7 hours sometimes for the maintenance every quarter. So that takes another 2 hours off. So now we're down to just like 2 hours per month. What this does is if they start building up time that I owe them, then if they get hit with a big project, they're not going to get hit with a big bill. If there is an emergency and I start consuming some hours, it levels their IT spending. So that's the selling point for this. What I recommend is you have something pretty solid here. I don't want to commit to certain duties, certain support things within those hours because I basically bill per hour. So if they call me and use me 10 extra hours that month, they're going to get billed for 10 extra hours over and above that at the end of the quarter. Now, one of the mistakes I made last year, we got hit with a lot of projects and a lot of work. And at the end of the quarter, this client was sort of blindsided with the increase. Now, I worked with them where they didn't pay it all at once and they were able to spread it over the next 3 months and what they owed me because it was significant. One of the things I'm now more aware of is rather than wait to the end of the quarter, if we start really exceeding the hours, I let them know at the end of the month, hey, this is where we're at. You've used, let's say you've contracted for 15 hours a month, you've already used 30. You know, so you're 15 hours over and we still have 2 months left. So try to give them a heads up. That doesn't happen often, but now I'm starting to look at, I have a couple clients now that are retainer clients and there's moves going on. Now, once there's a move happening, that's where the hours just get sucked up. And there are so many hours based on doing the walkthroughs of the new site, getting all the systems where they want me to move the computers, where they want me to take responsibility of shutting them down, wrapping them, and then taking them. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of money. We know, and I've kind of gave them a ballpark of what that's going to be, so there's no surprise. But it's not a guarantee. If I say it's probably going to take 10 hours, if it's 15 or 20, they're getting billed for that. I'm not just going to eat those extra hours. My team works per hour for all clients. The big difference here is if you are not a retainer client, you're getting billed at a higher rate. So you want to take advantage of saving money, so I have a lower rate for the retainer. Hope that helps. Long email here, and this is from Josh. I have written into the show before. I am the gamer that made a few extra bucks by upgrading laptops with SSDs per your recommendation. Between that and building gaming PCs, I actually made some business cards to hand out at my workplace and done quite well for an evening hobby. Today, I'm writing into the show because I'm at somewhat of a crossroads in my professional career, and I thought, who better to ask for some career advice than Mike himself? I worked 5 years at a huge manufacturing plant where I started in the fabrication department, eventually getting a promotion into the engineering department. That's great. I was about 5 months into my new job training, mostly SolidWorks and process design, lean manufacturing, when they announced they were closing down the plant and moving to Mexico. Unfortunately, this was my second high-level manufacturing job in a row to do this. Long story short, per the NAFTA trade agreement, the unemployment office stepped in and offered to pay for 2 years of retraining, biweekly check included. Luckily, I already had an associate's degree. I went to my local university, and oddly enough, the only program that fit within the unemployment office's two-year window was Bachelor's Technology Management Information Systems. That was over a year ago, and I am now over halfway through the program. Classes such as Intro to Networking, Databases, IS Analysis and Design, Healthcare IT, a lot of management classes as well, Project Management, Organizational Management, Quality Management, Engineering Economics, and of course, all of the general education as well. And finally, I'm getting to the point of why I am writing today. In a few months, I am going to have to decide what internship I want to shoot for, which I feel is very important. You learn new skills by study and practice. And so far, all I've had is study. The information systems advisor is helping me. She knows the CTO of a major hospital in the area. She also mentioned a couple help desk options. My biggest weakness is sysadmin skills, and the only networking experience is my home network. But it's not your typical home network with all the gaming PCs and laptops. I know my router inside and out. I have a small NAT and have configured all the ports for the best ping for gaming. My strength is researching and learning online, as well as listening to your podcast every week for years now. I have two questions. What kind of internship do you think would be best to shoot for? And I know you do well in interviews, so what would your advice for how best to explain myself in an interview? I know this has been a bit long-winded, but I don't write in often, so I figured I would make it a good one. Thanks for the show. Yours truly, Josh. First, send me your first draft and shot at a resume and email me miketechshow@gmail.com. I will do my best as a draft and an edit, and I'll give my 2 cents. I'm also going to send you links to my interview podcast I've done a long time ago, and I believe they are still stood the test of time and they are valid now as they were years ago for preparing for the job interview. I think that's important. Now, for the internship, couple things. What do you enjoy doing? And from your email, you like to research, you like to search, you like to tweak. Maybe desktops start there. Most of the jobs that I've seen, you build a foundation of desktops. And you're watching the network team a little bit, and you work side by side with them sometimes on projects and things, but learn the desktops, become an expert at the desktops, and then move on into network. You might want to get an entry-level position, especially an internship, for network administration. You got to find what you enjoy doing. And that's what my passion, and I didn't know this in the beginning, was networking. I just fell in love with that, with the system administration, with working with the network protocols on devices, getting things. I was fascinated with making things talk to each other. Years ago, it was more difficult to have a Mac talk within a regular Windows environment, or it wasn't obvious. And they're the things that I would go after to try to fix and figure out, because it increased my value. One of the other things that it's not so important today was email administration. And I loved working with Exchange Server in its infancy and when it was first starting out. And that gave me a leg up on other opportunities in the corporate world. So I leveraged my experience with Exchange Server to really get jobs. And then even some of the consulting that I started doing after I left the corporate world. What you want to do is find out what you enjoy doing. And then it doesn't hurt to have multiple disciplines. I think you might want to look at the desktop support workstations. I think it's important to go through and work at a help desk. You're only going to grow and learn from that customer-client interaction, which is the other employees. It's a good training ground. And then possibly look for positions in the networking teams and try to get in at an entry level and maybe cross over after you've done paid some dues in desktop world, move to networking and then start working your way through that. What about the management courses? Project management is so important, and it's a skill that's often overlooked internally at a lot of companies, and they end up looking for consultants to help them with project management. There's not a lot of people that can raise their hand and say, boy, I know how to do that. I can help run that project. You mentioned some management classes. I'd be curious, what did you like? I know it's all learning and it's all school and it's all just book. When I started Drexel University, I entered in chemical engineering. And after 2 years, I hated every minute of it. I wasn't having fun. I wasn't enjoying it. And that's what made me take a hard look at changing majors. And I ended up switching to business because I wasn't enjoying it. I didn't like it. I was great at math and chemistry, but when you put it all together with physics and thermodynamics and everything and mixed it all up in practical real-world problems, I'm like, I don't want to be doing this for the rest of my life. This is not what I like. So I didn't find computers till I was on my own after college that I started. It became a hobby. The hobby turned into a passion, the passion to an obsession, the obsession into a career. That's how I started. And I was doing it all on my own. And I had the guts to go out there and actually look for computer positions with no background in computers because it was all self-taught. And I had the fortunate opportunities to be able to explore and experiment on the job because they needed someone to do that. And that's where you want to look. An internship that gives you the freedom of exploring and learning. And you want to look at an environment that promotes that culture of growing and learning. And that's what you want to look for. I hope, Josh, that this helped you. Final question from Marius. You know, it's funny. I hear the name Marius, and I think of the character name in Sneaky Pete. Anyway, Marius asks, there are two channels of your show, and he sends a screenshot. Any difference between them? Any reason to choose one over the other? There are multiple ways to get my show. The one true feed is the one that I personally edit and manage weekly. And that's at mikenation.net/miketechshow.xml. That is the main feed that I manually edit that I've been doing from day one. And that feed is under my complete control. Now, there's another feed that's under the control of the Tech Podcast Network that I belong to. I don't want to opt for one or the other. What if that network goes away? I've lost my feed. Yes, it's my feed, but they take the feed and they promote it to iTunes and other things and other places and directories. What happens if that goes away? It's just like my podcast is hosted at Libsyn. What if Libsyn goes away? I have to always be in control of my content and my feed. That's very, very important to me. If you wanted to pick a feed, although that's the most difficult for me to maintain, it's the feed that I've been using since day one of my podcast. Only it wasn't MikeNation.net at the time. It was Mike Tech Show. Little story, real quick. Where did Mike Nation come from? One day, years ago in the chat, it came up, why don't you go, it's really Mike Nation. My followers and everybody, it was, and I had dreams of having, here was the Mike Tech Show, would have been the first podcast. I had these aspirations of a Mike music show, a Mike movie show, a Mike food show, and it would all be under the umbrella of Mike Nation. So that's where that change came from, in the hopes of having all these other podcasts, which I've never had time to embrace or do. Anyway, that's why the names and MikeNation.net is the main feed, because it used to be MikeTechShow.com, which you still can, and it redirects. But there's no real hosting behind MikeTechShow.com. It's just a redirect to MikeNation.net. And that caused problems with the initial feed, too, a while back. So with all that, though, one thing I want to mention as other podcasts, Monday night, April 9th, Carrie Holzman and myself are scheduled to do a Tech Vets. So we are locking in. And I bring that up because we have an Amazon link that is in the show notes. To show your support for the show, you have to come to MikeTechShow.com or MikeNation.net, and you have to click on the link, and it brings you to Amazon. And then during that session, whatever you purchase, we'll give credit. It's Carrie Holzman's link. We both thank you for your continued support. Please remember to support the sponsors: Instant House Call, Malwarebytes Toolset. You will love it. Links are in the show notes. I want to thank everybody for downloading, staying subscribed, being part of the show, supporting the show. I really appreciate it. And I'll be back here next week, same time, same channel. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.